sure, because I'm discuss and explain some things to you this afternoon. And I will finish the discussion I've been doing about various aspects of non-abelian gauge theory. So first, I will present the final and most important results of the analysis of renormalization and the renormalizability of non-abelian gauge theory at one loop, which I just briefly talked about yesterday, which is a result of the calculation. So we have seen that if we start from a gauge theory with an action which is minus 1/2 trace of, well, let us write it without the trace, f mu nu minus, with some coupling constant here, minus 1/4, plus action for the fermion field, I d slash minus m psi, plus the gauge fixing terms. Well, the results of the analysis that I have presented in a very, very sketchy way, in particular all the details of the proof and of the cancellation and of this, and the fact that the symmetry factor that the symmetry, the gauge symmetry of the series is respected in the calculation, amounts to the fact that the theory is indeed renormalizable, at least at one loop, but it's true, in fact. It's true at all orders. And the renormalization amounts to renormalizing three quantities. First, the coupling constant, which is in fact g squared, the coupling constant has to be renormalized. Second, the mass of the fermions, the fermion mass has to be renormalized. And finally, the normalization of the fermion field, of the Dirac field, if you want, of the fermion field, has to be renormalized. This means that, in fact, you, instead of dealing with that, you must deal with a renormalized coupling constant, a renormalized mass of the fermions. And in fact, the operator, what do I mean by renormalization of the field? Renormalization of the field means that, in fact, when you are computing green functions for the theory, and then in order to compute S matrix element, you must consider a field. If you want that the field applied to the vacuum, for instance, if you want that the field operator applied to the vacuum of the theory creates one particle state with normalization 1, this means that the field has to be normalized in such a way that when applied to a vacuum, it creates a one particle state with a normalization of 1. So that otherwise, if you apply the operator, the psi operator you had put originally in the action, you can get a one particle state, but with some factor, so you have to divide by this factor in order to normalize the wave function of the one particle state in the correct way in the calculation. So it just means renormalization of the fields means this, that you have to normalize in a proper way the creation at the annihilation operator in order to create 1, 2, 3 particle states with proper normalization for doing quantum calculation. Okay? And this is not, well, this is an important aspect of the physics, the normalization of the fields, but of course, in the functional integral, for instance, you integrate over the field, so the field psi and psi bar are dummy variables. So this has not a direct consequences for the correlation function. It will have indirect consequences, but not direct. Okay, so the important thing is that the fermion mass are renormalized, but we have seen also that if we start from massless fermions, they stay massless. Okay, so the important thing is the renormalization of the coupling constant. And in the same way as we have discussed in the case of the 5-4 theory, the coupling constant becomes, in fact, a running coupling constant. So, in fact, running coupling constant, which means that the renormalized coupling constant GR depends on the scale, on the energy or momentum scale at which it is measured or defined. It satisfies a renormalization group equation. So this scale, let us call it mu, and it satisfies a renormalization group equation. There is a beta function associated to this coupling constant. Okay, and the results of the calculation, which was done as I explained by Toft in 1972, but this was published in a paper by Toft and Veltman, I think. Veltman in 73 or 4, I don't remember. And the calculation was done independently by Politzer and by Gross and Vilcek in 73. In fact, there were some Russians who did part of the calculation a few years before, but the results went completely unnoticed at the time. The result is that the beta function for the Young-Mills theory is for minus G3 over 4 pi squared. And now there are factors coming from all the diagrams which I have been discussing last time. And there are factors which come from the symmetry group. Okay, so in fact, I will give you the result for the group SUN. So if you take n equal 2, you will have the SU2 case I have been discussing. But there is 11 over 3 factors times n2 minus 1 divided by 2n. That's the contribution of the gauge field. Gauge fields plus, of course, the gauge fixing terms. So if you do a calculation, you must take into account the contribution of the gauge field and of the ghosts. They give some results. At the end, you obtain this factor, which do not depend on the gauge fixing factor, as expected, because you want a theory which is renormalized in a gauge invariant way. Okay. And then you have a contribution from the matter field, and the contribution from the matter field turns out to be nf times a coefficient, which I will write 1/2, which is 1/2. Okay, and so that's the contribution of the fermion. Fermions, at least if they are in the fundamental representation. Representation, which means that for Dirac fields, that there are n component Dirac fermions. So for SU2, we have the two Dirac fermions which carry one of the SU2 charge. So you have, for instance, the blue fermions and the red fermions. Okay. Yes?
And what is NF?
And NF is, of course, the number of fermions. NF is equal to the number of fermions, because you may take n copies of the same fermions. You know, you may take NF different kind of fermions we carry. Each species of fermions carry the SU2 number or the SU3 number. Okay. And so, yes? It's a number of family. Yes. Or rather, the number of quarks. Because the family comes from when you associate with the SU2.
Right.
So, for instance, for the. Yes. Okay.
Is this true of 1 loop?
Pardon?
Is this beta function to 1 loop, or is
this? This is the beta function at 1 loop. Then you have higher order. This is the beta function at 1 loop. Okay? So you see for, and of course, n is what is called the number of colors, because it corresponds to the number of different colors I have been associated to the quantum number on Monday, on Wednesday. And so the number of color for SU2 is 2. The number of color for SU3, namely for QCD, will be 3. Okay? And the important thing to notice is that this coefficient is positive. So I put a minus sign here. So in fact, the coefficient associated to the gauge field is negative, and the coefficient associated to the contribution of the fermion is positive. Okay? So for electrodynamics for U1 field, you see that the beta function, this term, is absent. And that's because in the case of the Maxwell field, the gauge field doesn't interact with itself. So it cannot, there cannot be any renormalization effects associated just to the electromagnetic field, while there is a renormalization of the charge because there are electron and positron pairs. Okay? So for the U1 field, the beta function is positive because you get a plus 4/3 of the number of fermions, and in quantum electrodynamics, this is one. While for the if n is equal to larger than 1, and in fact, if n is larger, if n is positive. So if n is larger than 1, but smaller than some critical value, which depend on the number of fermions, beta is if beta is negative. So in particular, in the case we are interested, for instance, n equal 2 and f equal 1, or n equal 3 and nf equal 3, because we have 3 families of, or 6, I don't remember, which is the case of QCD, where you have 3 families of quarks. So in fact, you have 6 different species of quarks, and you have 3 colors. This coefficient is negative. If this coefficient is positive, so the beta function is negative. And when the beta function is negative, it means that we have asymptotic freedom. Namely, it means that the effective coupling goes to 0 when the scale goes to infinity. So the theory is weakly coupled at high energy. It's asymptotically free at high energy. And it becomes strongly coupled at low energy. And that's, in fact, the most important properties of non-abelian gauge theories, is this properties of asymptotic freedom, which, in fact, states that implies that there are good candidates for a consistent quantum field theory of interaction between matter fields and vector fields carrying some interaction associated to the charge of the matter field, because it's a theory which will be consistent at high energy. Yes?
So the dot 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 at the beta function is higher.
Pardon?
So the dot 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 at the end of the beta function, is that just from higher loops?
Yes, yes. This means higher loops. And this has been computed. But the leading effect is given by this because of asymptotic freedom, and because one is interested in what's happening at high energy. At high energy, the coupling constant is small, and therefore the dominant effect in the running of the coupling constant is given by the first order term in the beta function. You see?
So this was up for SU1. How do you know if it works for U1?
For?
U1 being that it's not.
Ah, yeah, yes, the SU1 is equal to 0. Yeah, SU1 is equal to 0, so this is, so in fact, the fact that it's 0 for U1 is not exactly described by associated to this part. But in fact, for U, you see, you have seen that SU, I explained yesterday that SU, that UN is always SUN
across U1, but this U1 decouples unless you couple it via, it can be coupled to this sector, but if you have other fields which mediate interaction, which is what's happened in the Weinberg Salam model of a weak interaction. In that case, it decouples. Decouples. Okay. So. Also, you're right. In fact, when I was stating that for L equal 1, it's 0, it's not exactly for the reason I stated. But that's true anyway. Okay. Okay, so in fact, this discovery and this calculation was the advent of the modern theory and the modern era of the formulation of the theory of all interaction between elementary particles. So that's a very, very important result. Okay. So now, there is something I haven't discussed much in my lecture, which is very important, so I think you should complain about that. It is that I haven't been discussing much of symmetries in quantum field theory. We have discussed a lot about symmetries in gauge theory. We have discussed about symmetries a little bit when discussing scale invariance, which is a symmetry of the theory, which is anomalous. In the case of 5-4 theory. But we have not been discussing the way symmetries are realized in quantum field theories, and in particular, the important phenomena of symmetry breaking. And I want to discuss, to divorce the last part of this lecture to the discussion of the X mechanism. And what is called gauge symmetry breaking. Because that's the important, that's the second important ingredient for the formulation of modern theory of interaction. One ingredient was the non-abelian gauge theories, and the other ingredient was this X mechanism, but it explains the properties of the electroweak interaction sector. So I will discuss it. First, I will discuss just what means symmetry breaking, because I'm not sure everybody. Breaking. And by symmetry breaking, I will mean what is called spontaneous symmetry breaking. If you have a symmetry in a theory, it can be broken because simply you are adding a term to the action which breaks the symmetry. It can be spoiled by quantum effects, and then the symmetry is said to be anomalous. And in both cases, it means that the theory doesn't have this symmetry, the real symmetry, the real theory. Doesn't satisfy the symmetry you started from because it's destroyed. The symmetry is not there anymore. In the case of spontaneous symmetry breaking, it's a more subtle mechanism when in a physical theory there is a symmetry, but it's hidden in the sense that you do not see this symmetry when you look at the property of the ground state of the theory. And let me give a simple example. I will state from a scalar field with two components. Components. Okay, that I call phi. So I take a scalar field which has two components, phi 1 and phi 2. Okay? So this is a bosonic field. And in fact, I have two kinds of particles, if you want. You can see that this is a theory which describes bosons, scalar bosons with no spin, no charge. And simply, as for the moment, they will have no charge. And simply, you have two kinds of bosons, bosons 1 and bosons 2, or boson red and boson blue. And now, I want to construct a theory for this theory, so I will take a Lagrangian for the theory, if you prefer, start from an action, which will be d4x. And then I have minus 1 half d mu phi d mu phi, and I take the
products of those two vectors. So this means, in fact, d mu phi 1, d mu phi 1 plus d mu phi 2, d mu phi 2. Okay? And then I had a potential term, v of phi, and I will consider that this potential, in fact, depends on phi squared. Well, of course, phi squared is phi 1 plus phi 2, phi 2. Okay? And I will take as a potential the only potential which is allowed by the fact that I want a theory which is renormalized in four dimensions. So I will take a potential of the form v of phi squared equal t over squared phi squared plus g over 4 phi to the 4. Okay? So this is a coupling constant. And t is a parameter which, if t is positive, would be the mass. Okay? So I will assume that, of course, that the coupling constant is positive. But I will be considering what's happening if t, instead of being positive, is negative. If t is positive, t is like the mass squared of the particle. And the potential v, if I make a picture of the potential v is something like that. Simply now, if I draw it in terms of the two components, phi 1 and phi 2, it is a potential which is like that, because it depends just on the radius, of the length of the vector. Okay. But you see that this theory has a, what's important, it has a U1 symmetry, which is a global or rigid U1 symmetry, because it means simply that I can change the, I can rotate in the plane. I can start phi and transform it into a rotation matrix R of theta times phi, where R of theta is cosine theta, sin theta, minus sin theta, cosine theta. Okay? So the properties of this theory, it has a global U1 symmetry. But theta, it's not a gauge symmetry. Theta is independent of x. Not a gauge, global. Not a local gauge symmetry. Very important. Okay. So now, what's happening if the parameter t is negative? It's a coupling constant of the theory, so a priori, it may very well be negative. If it's negative, it's easy to see that the potential is not like that, but the potential is like that. Here I represent v, here I represent one of the phi. The potential is low now like that, because for small phi, this is negative, so the potential is curved in this direction. And of course, if phi becomes larger, the phi to the fourth terms become more important. And so the potential is bounded from below. But the real minimum of the potential is not at the origin. It's somewhere here. And since the theory is invariant under rotation in the space of fields, in fact, this is how the potential looks like. It looks like the end, the bottom of a well, and in the middle of the well you have some hill, some butt which comes out. So in fact, the minimum of the potential is phi equals zero, while here the minimum of the potential, there is a continuum of minima of the potential. Okay. So this means that the classical vacuum of the theory, here the classical vacuum of the theory is described by phi equals zero. While here the classical, we have many classical minima, which means ground states
of the theory, which has the form phi equals some unit vector times the some expectation value of phi, where phi naught is just the value of the field at the minima of the potential. And if you solve the equation, you found very easily, it's an elementary calculation, that phi naught will be related, in fact, to the negative value of t. So, in fact, the relation between phi naught and t is that phi naught squared equals minus t divided by the coupling constant. Okay? So if t is negative, the field in the ground set gets a non-trivial vacuum expectation value. Okay? So in that case, one says that the U1 symmetry is spontaneously broken. Okay. What does it mean that the U1 symmetry is spontaneously broken? It means that the U1 symmetry, the rotational symmetry, is still a symmetry of the theory. It's a symmetry of the action. Therefore, it will be a symmetry of the Hamiltonian once you quantize the theory. But the vacuum of the theory is not invariant under this symmetry. The vacuum state, 0, is not invariant. And what does it mean that it's not invariant? It doesn't mean that the symmetry is broken. It means that if you apply a generator of the symmetry to the vacuum state here, for instance, imagine that you are in a vacuum state described by a point here. If you apply a generator to the symmetry, you go to another vacuum of the theory, which is physically equivalent to the first one, but which is different. You see? Which means that if you consider what is the generator of the symmetry, are the charge, is the charge, and that it means that if you apply the charge to the vacuum, you don't get zero. Okay? So now, what is the current associated to this symmetry? There is a current associated to this symmetry, and it's better to write this symmetry as I will introduce a complex field, which will be phi 1 plus I phi 2, so a complex scalar field. So phi will be a complex field. Phi bar will be its complex conjugate. Okay, and it's better to write in terms of this complex field, the field, because if you apply Noether theorem, what you get is that the current associated to this symmetry is I times d mu phi bar times phi minus phi bar d mu phi. This is the current associated to this symmetry. Okay, the charge will be, as usual, integral over a three-dimensional hypersurface of the time component of the current. And you can check if you write that and you apply it to the vacuum of the theory when you quantize it, that this is indeed not, that Q of 0 is not equal to 0. You see? Also, Q commutes with the Hamiltonian because it's a symmetry of the theory. So it has to commute with the Hamiltonian. Okay? So now let us go back to, now let us see what's happening when we expand around the true vacuum of the theory. So if we expand around the true vacuum of the theory, I will assume that, for instance, that the expectation value of phi I assume that the expectation value of phi is in the first direction. Okay? So I'm assuming that I'm here. Okay? And then I want to write the field phi as a perturbation. So now I am trying to quantize the field. So what I'm doing is that I must start from the physical classical vacuum in order to quantize the theory. So what I must write is that phi equals phi naught plus some perturbation field that I will write phi of x. So now this is the field and some phi which I will call pi of x. Okay? And you see the idea? So instead of expanding the field here, this is a classical vacuum of the theory, phi naught, and this is phi one, this is phi two. This is the expectation value of the field, and this I call this h, and this I call pi. Okay? And let me rewrite the action of the theory if I am. Let me rewrite the action if I do this expansion. Okay. Remember, V was equal to, I erased it. So what's important is that V was equal to minus T over 2 phi squared plus G over 4 phi to the 4. Okay? I make this change of transformation, and I rewrite the action. I rewrite the potential. So I rewrite the potential as a function of pi and h. And, well, it's not a very complicated calculation, but in the end, you end up with a term which is minus, and I will explain what this means, minus m squared over 8 phi 0 squared plus m squared over 2 h squared plus m squared over 2 phi naught h cubed plus h pi squared plus m squared over 8 phi naught squared pi 4 plus h 4 plus 2 pi squared I squared. Okay? So this is just elementary algebra when I rewrite this V of phi in terms of H and pi. That's elementary algebra. And what is this new term M? M is simply M squared is 2 times the Kubli constant times the square of the expectation value of the field. Okay? So, what does it mean? This, and of course, the action now. So now I have a new potential, let us call it U, which is the potential of U of H and pi. Okay? And the action is, of course, d4x minus 1 half of d pi squared plus dh squared okay, minus u of h and pi. Okay. And now let us, so this is a constant. This constant comes simply from the fact that the potential is like that. So the potential at the minima has a negative value. So this is the energy, if you want, the energy of the vacuum, which is negative because I am in these states. And let us concentrate on these terms because that's the only quadratic term in the field. Those are terms of order 3 in the field, h and pi, and those are terms of order 4. And so you see that those are the mass terms from the theory. Mass terms for the theory. This is a kinetic term. This is a mass term.
Okay, and these are the interaction terms.
And you see immediately from this expression that H has a mass because the free term for H is dH squared plus m squared H squared. So H is a massive field with mass m. But there is no analogous mass term for the pi field. Pi is a massless field. You see? Okay. And so now remember that in fact the potential is something like that. It has rotational symmetry. So why do in this situation do I have two fields, one which is massive and one which is massless? It's very easy to understand because, in fact, if you have a quantum field theory with a general let's just write it because I will need it. If I have a quantum field theory with a general potential, in fact, the mass of the excitation are the mass squared are proportional to the curvature of the potential. It's very easy to see because the curvature of the potential gives you the term which is of order 2 in the variation of the field. And you see that in this situation, there is one direction, the h direction, when the potential is curved. And there is one direction, the direction around the set of minima, where the potential is flat. And it is flat because the symmetry is spontaneously broken. So one direction, in one direction, the potential has a curvature, and therefore there is a massive massive excitation associated to this direction. This is the massive field H, and in this direction you have massless excitation because the potential is flat. Those massless excitation are the field pi, which is massless. So the fact that the field pi is massless is just a natural consequence of the fact that the symmetry is spontaneously broken. Okay? So in fact, the pi field is called a Goldstone boson. It's still a field with no spin, and it is massless. Okay, and it is massless because there is a spontaneous breaking of the symmetry. Okay, and in fact, it's a general property of any quantum field theory and of any continuous group of symmetry. If you have a symmetry which is spontaneously broken because for some dynamical reason, the vacuum is not symmetric under some of the charge of the theory, there is a theorem which tells that there are massless particles associated in the spectrum of the theory, which are the Goldstone boson. So it's a theorem, in fact, that to any spontaneously breaking of a symmetry are associated Goldstone bosons. Okay. But you see that it has a very simple interpretation. Okay. Okay. So now, you can play with those games, and you can check that you can write the current in terms of the now, in terms of the H and of the pi field, and you can check that in the quantum theory you have indeed the fact that the vacuum is not conserved by the charge. Okay. So you have massless. So what do I have in the theory? I will write this in that way. I have now a massive field, which is a boson with mass m. I have a pi field, which is, let us write it. I have the Goldstone bosons pi, which has a mass, which is zero. I have the massive field H, which has a mass, which is positive. OK.
Okay. So the propagator of the pi is just the propagator of a massless boson. The propagator of the hat H is a propagator of the massive boson. And now you have interaction terms. But you see, you have complicated interaction terms because you have interaction terms here where you have 4H which can interact. This is this terms. You have an interaction term where you have H which can interact with 2 pi field. You have an interaction terms where you have 4H which can interact. You have an interaction term where you have 2H and 2 pi, and you have an interaction term where you have 4 pi. Okay? But you see that those there are relations between the coupling constant of this term and the coupling constant of this term. The coupling constant associated to these 5 different interactions are not at all independent. They are related because of the U1 symmetry. U1 symmetry. The U1 symmetry fixes the relative values of those coefficients. If those symmetries, if those relations between those coefficients here and those coefficients here, together with the relation with the mass of the H particle, are not satisfied, the U1 symmetry will be broken. And you will have some strange potential, very irregular, and U1 will be broken. U1 broken, but broken explicitly. Okay? So it's only for this specific choice of the coupling that the U1 symmetry is spontaneously broken. But it's still a symmetry of the theory. Okay, so that's all what I want to say about a theory where you have a continuous symmetry, which is here the simple U1 symmetry, but when it is spontaneously broken. What you must keep in mind is that each time that the symmetry is spontaneously broken, then you have a Goldstone boson. Okay? Good. So now the question is, what is happening if phi is now coupled to a gauge theory? So the original field phi, and therefore the field pi and h, carry a U1 symmetry. So they carry a charge. You see? They carry some charge, but it's a global charge of the theory. And what's happening now if this charge is coupled to the U1 gauge field? So here I want to couple phi, which is phi1, phi2, to a U1 gauge field, namely some electromagnetic field. I have one charge, and I couple this to the photons, which will mediate interaction between those two charged bosons. Okay. If T is positive, remember the T of the original potential here, I get a theory which is simply what is called the massive quantum, I get something which is called the scalar quantum electrodynamics. Instead of having electrons and positrons coupled to the electromagnetic field, I have a charge boson, and its antiparticle, which has the opposite charge, which are coupled to the electromagnetic field. But otherwise, the physics is quite similar to that of electromagnetism, of quantum electrodynamics, except that there are no effects associated to the spin of the electron. So there's charge spin zero particle interacting with the electromagnetic field. Okay? So particles with the same charge are repelled, and particles with opposite charge are attract each other, and there is a sensible quantum theory of this kind of theory. I just have scalar a theory of scalar quantum electrodynamics with scalar electrons. Okay. So that's something which is, there is nothing really new compared to what's happening in quantum electrodynamics, except that the particles carry no spin. Now, when T is negative, it's a completely different story. It's a completely different story for the following reason. Remember that we had this picture when you have a continuum of inequivalent vacua of the theory. We have a continuum of inequivalent ground state. Well, they are equivalent under the symmetry, but they are different. The scalar products of those two states are different from one. Okay? And we had the pi excitation here. Forget about what's happening when the U1 symmetry is explicitly broken by a change in the potential. So we keep into the case where there is a U1 symmetry, you know. We have the pi fields here. Field, the Goldstone boson, whose action is to go from, in fact, acting on a state with an operator creating Goldstone bosons, moves you from one vacuum, one ground state of the three, to another ground state. Okay? Because the pi field generates U1 transformation. Okay? And remember that I had this idea that I wrote phi as phi 1 plus I phi 2. The U1 gets you transformation amounts to change phi into exponential I alpha phi. This is the U1 symmetry acting on the phi, on the field phi considered as a complex field because it's just a linear combination of the two real fields. Okay, when and so the pi field acting with the pi phi field on some on state, in fact, makes some rotation on the field. Okay, but now we are coupling this theory to a gauge field, which means that this symmetry becomes a local gauge invariance. So, if we have a local gauge invariance, we can always go back by a gauge transformation. See? If you are trying to perform a rotation on the state of the theory by applying some operator containing creation and annihilation operator of the Goldstone bosons, you can always go back to the original state by performing a local gauge transformation, which is a local symmetry of the theory. And so the question in that case is, what's happening to the U1 symmetry? Is it still there? Is it not there? And how is it realized in the symmetry, in the theory? Okay? So, in order to do that, we shall start again from the same theory. But now, I've write it coupled to the electromagnetic field. So I keep the notation, which is convenient, that phi, I will treat it as a complex field, because then the gauge transformation I realize in the following way. And now I have two fields in the theory when it's coupled. I have a complex scalar field, okay, which contains the two real scalar fields. And I have an gauge potential, which is just the ordinary gauge potential of Maxwell's theory. Okay? I'm back to Abelian gauge theory. Remember, I'm always now dealing with a theory with a U1 group of symmetry. What is the action for the theory? Well, you have a complex scalar field coupled to the gauge potential. So this is the action of scalar QED we have seen in general. So this is d4x minus 1/4 of d mu a nu minus d nu a mu squared. This is the square of the stress tensor of the electromagnetic field. Okay. And now I have what I have to do in order to replace to couple the field to the electromagnetic field. I just have to replace the ordinary derivative by covariant derivative. And I have now this potential V, and let us write this V of phi bar phi. Okay. Okay, so now d bar mu, d mu are the covariant derivative, d mu minus e a mu, where e is the charge of the field phi. Okay, and a mu is the field. And V, remember, is as always T over 2 phi bar phi plus G over 4 phi by phi. Phi squared. So this is the same potential as before, simply written in terms of the complex field and its complex conjugate, phi bar equal phi 1 minus I phi 2. Okay? And this is the action of scalar. So this is the action of, I alluded before, this is the action of scalar quantum electrodynamics. Yes? Pardon?
Do phi 1 and phi 2 need to have the same charge?
Yes, because if they don't have the same charge, the interaction with the electromagnetic field will break the U1 symmetry. And it will not be, it cannot be a gauge symmetry of the theory. So phi 1 and phi 2 needs to have the same charge. Or if you want, phi as a charge plus E and phi bar as a charge minus E. You see, because under a gauge transformation, phi transforms as phi transform as E pi alpha E phi, and phi bar transforms as E minus I alpha E phi under a gauge transformation. Okay? And you see from this equation that phi 1 and phi 2 carry the same charge. Okay? Okay. So, as I said before, if T is negative, in appearance, nothing changes. We expect that phi will get an expectation value. But because of the gauge invariance, now we can always go back to the original ground state we started from. Okay. So now, if we want to quantize the theory, remember that we need to fix a gauge. We need to fix a gauge. Because now we have a gauge invariance under any local gauge transformation. And this is the transformation, and the associated transformation, I mu, is transformed into A mu plus d mu alpha of x. These are the gauge transformation.
Is that p bar max, p bar?
Pardon?
E to the minus I of x, e.
Yes, phi bar. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, it's of course phi bar. Yes, okay. So this is the effect of the gauge transformation. So we have seen for quantum electrodynamics or for the non-abelian gauge fields, we need to introduce the gauge fixing. And usually, the gauge fixing term is performed by fixing condition of the electromagnetic field. But you see that when you perform a gauge transformation, you make a transformation on the electromagnetic field, and you make altogether a transformation on the scalar field. So instead of gauge fixing
on the AMU, we shall introduce the gauge fixing condition on the scalar on the complex, sorry, complex field phi.
You see, since the group of gauge transformation acts on both fields at the same time, I may very well fix the gauge condition on the field phi instead of the electromagnetic potential. The important is I fix one condition. Okay. And since gauge transformation acts by rotating locally the field phi, for any configuration of field phi which is complex, I can always, at least locally, find a gauge transformation which rotates it so that phi becomes real. You see? For any, if I have here, if I have a phi of x which is complex, okay, somewhere here, I can always find an alpha of x so that phi e to the I alpha e is real. It's obvious. You just multiply by minus the phase of the field phi. So I will choose as my gauge condition. My gauge condition will be simply that im of phi of x equals 0 for any point of x. Okay? For any x. So this means that phi of x is real. Phi of x is real. And this gauge fixing condition is called the unitarity gauge. Okay. Okay, so now let us see what this happens in terms of now if the symmetry is spontaneously broken, this gauge condition amounts to write that that pi is equal to 0. Remember that pi is the imaginary part of phi. With my notation, pi is the imaginary part of phi, and h plus phi, phi 0, is the real part of phi. Okay? So if I re-express my original action in terms of the pi, the h, and the mu field, okay, my gauge condition amounts to just set that pi equals 0. So h is still there, mu is still there in the gauge fixed theory. So once I have made my choice of gauge fixing by stating that phi is always real, the pi field has disappeared. The H field and the mu field are still there. And the fact that the pi field has disappeared, the fact that the Goldstone boson is no more there, is just a statement that I can always absorb a rotation by a counter gauge transformation. Okay? So now, in the gauge fixed theory, I have a theory which involves only the H field and the mu field. Okay? And now let us rewrite this action when t is equal is negative in terms of those variables, the H field and the mu field. Okay? So it's an exercise which is quite simple, and we end up with the following action. We end up with an action with a gauge fixed condition, which is integral d for x. And what do I get? First, I get, of course, the d mu amu action. Nothing in change. Minus 1/2 d mu amu minus d mu amu squared. 1/4. Okay, because here I have not fixed any gauge condition on the mu field, so the Maxwell action for the field is unchecked. Now, what do I get for the action of the phi field? Okay, remember that phi now is real. D mu, but d mu contains the electromagnetic field. But remember now that phi is equal to h plus phi zero. So in any covariant derivative, there is no phi naught plus h. Not here, but any phi here has to be replaced by a phi naught plus h. So if I write that, what do I get? I get minus 1/2 of d mu h minus I, and I can write this in this way, d mu h squared plus e squared mu phi naught plus mu h squared. Okay, this is what becomes the square of the covariant derivative of the phi field expressed in this gauge. And there is a phi naught because now phi is phi naught plus h. Okay? And then I have the ordinary potential that I've written before minus the potential which was m squared over 2 h squared plus m squared over 2 phi naught h cubed plus m4 of 8 phi 0 squared h to the 4. This term simplifies because there is no pi field anymore. The pi field has disappeared, so what remains here is a self-interaction of the H field with itself. Okay? Okay. So now something very important happens. What are the kinetic term? What are the term of order 2? For the H, the term of order 2 for the H field is as before, minus d mu h squared minus m squared over 2 h squared. So the H field is still a massive boson with mass m. Okay? Now look at what's happening to the electromagnetic field. The quadratic term in the electromagnetic field, there is these terms, but there is this new term. Because now I have an, I'm sorry, that's an E here. Yes, no, it's this one. Here I have an A mu phi naught squared. So for the electromagnetic term, the term is minus 1/4 d mu A nu minus d nu A mu squared minus 1/2 e squared phi naught squared mu squared. So this is the term of the electromagnetic interaction, and this is a mass term for the gauge field. Now I have a mass term for the gauge field with a mass proportional to e squared phi zero, to e phi zero, I'm sorry, because this is e squared phi squared. So the mass of the gauge field is proportional to the vacuum expectation value of the field phi in the vacuum in the global theory. And it's non-zero. Okay? And finally, I have this interaction terms here, and the interaction here I have an interaction term which is A mu, which is between the electromagnetic field and H. And if I work out what's going on here, I will end up with a potential of the form. So let us keep this here. I end up with interaction term of the form. So I had this term. I had this minus 1/2 of d mu h squared plus m squared h squared. This is the term for the boson. And then I had the interaction term, which are those terms plus an a mu h squared plus 2 times e squared. I'm sorry, yes. Times e squared plus 2 e squared a mu squared h phi 0. OK? So now you have a theory where now you have no pi anymore because it has been absorbed by the gauge fixing, but you have an A mu field which has a propagator, which is the propagator of a massive vector boson. It's a vector because it carries the mu indices. I have the H field as before, which is a massive scalar boson. And I have interaction terms. And as interaction terms, I have the interaction between these terms, which come from this one, which is a term which was already there in scalar quantum electrodynamics. I have the terms, three boson interactions, three H field and four H field. So those terms are the terms which are already there in scalar electrodynamics. And I have a new term, which is a term where the H field interacts with the gauge field. So this is an H, this is an A mu, this is an A mu. So you see that the H field can just disappear and transform into two photons, if you want. Okay, and this term is proportional to phi naught. So this is the term which is there only because we have gauge, we have this breaking of the symmetry. You see? So the terms which have appeared here because of the breaking of the symmetry. So the fact that the symmetry, the U1 symmetry, is broken are twofold. The consequence is that first, the A mu becomes massive with a mass ma equal e phi naught, and there is a new coupling here, new coupling between the electromagnetic field and the H field, which is proportional to E squared phi naught. You see? So you see that both couplings disappear when the symmetry breaking doesn't take place and recovers the standard rule of scalar electrodynamics. Okay.
So the first term in action, you do your gauge fixing.
The first term.
Kinetic terms of the phi field. There are cross terms as well.
Well, it's there. It's a kinetic term of the H field.
So isn't it?
It's an
h. With a gauge field.
Pardon?
You don't have a d mu h and a gauge field to cross them.
I'm sorry, yeah, I'm not sure I understand.
In the action here, you have this d mu h.
Yeah.
I just rewrite this term as, I'm sorry, I say this, I'm rewriting, I was just rewriting this term as these terms plus these terms plus these terms. I'm sorry. So if you want to be. I was splitting a little bit my. So I am rewriting the action as this term plus. This term. Okay. So this action is equal to this plus this. Yeah. Pardon?
Because in the original gauge fixed action, there are no cross terms either between the. Between it's something that's complex conjugate.
Sorry. No, some cross term has disappeared because here I am taking this is d mu phi times the complex conjugate of d mu phi. Okay. Because the action has to be real. So, of course, you may say that, there are cross terms between. A mu phi naught and h. But those cross terms appear because of the fact that this term is real. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Just do the calculation and you find them. Okay. Such cross term would violate, of course, the U1 symmetry because you start from an action and it becomes imaginary. Okay. So. So, how much time? Okay, so I have still. We started late, so I still have 10 minutes. About. So, what's the conclusion of this analysis? The conclusion of this analysis is that now the spectrum of the theory contains one massive scalar boson, which is H, and one massive vector boson, which is A mu. Okay. And you can, for instance, starting from these terms, and compute what is the propagator for the scalar boson. So the propagator for the propagator for the gauge for the vector boson A mu, if you compute it, is now. P mu nu of P equals, if I am right, minus I times P squared plus M squared times eta mu nu, this is the signature of the metric, plus K mu divided by M squared. Okay? So you see that this is the ordinary term which would be there for the photon if the photon was massless. But because now the vector field is massive, you have a p squared plus m squared. Remember that p squared is minus p0 squared plus p squared, because I'm using the Euclidean signature, and eta mu nu is minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, as usual. Okay? Oh, yes, sorry. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you see that there is a pole in the propagator at P naught equal at the energy equal P squared plus M squared. So you see that the mass shell condition, let us write it here and we shall be done. Mass shell condition. The mass shell condition for the vector field is, of course, E squared equal K squared plus, oh, I'm sorry, and this is not the M squared. This is the mass of the. This is the mass, little mass m squared, where the mass is this mass, e phi squared. Okay. M a equal e phi naught. Okay.
So the Gauge boson is a massive particle. And now you can look at what are the allowed polarization. Still, it's a vector. So still, it is a vector. It is a vector. So it carries a polarization, E mu. And still, because of the remnant of the gauge symmetries, you found that there are only three polarizations allowed. Only three polarizations are allowed. You can see that by just checking that when you are on mass shell, whether a state with a momentum and an energy satisfies this condition and a given polarization has still a finite energy because you have to project the polarization. And you find that still the condition epsilon mu k mu equals zero has to be satisfied, or let us say p mu, where p is the momentum of the p mu is, as usual, E k is the momentum, the impulsion of the gauge field. So this still has to be satisfied. And you can check this just by looking at the form of this action. So this means that now, since the vector field has a mass, it can be at rest. You can consider a gauge field, a vector boson staying in your laboratory is there. You see? Yes?
Basically, we had a boson, and then we fixed our gauge, and we get to our freedom, and from that into our logical
node. That's what I'm going to explain, yes. So, okay, but I want to discuss a little bit the properties of the vector boson. So the vector boson carries the polarization, but this polarization must still satisfy this condition. And therefore, this means that if it's at rest, for instance, it means that its p mu is just E zero. And this implies that epsilon mu must be of the form zero, some epsilon space like. Okay? So epsilon must be the polarization of the vector field can must be any space-like vector. So now you have three independent polarization which are allowed for the vector field, as I stated. Okay, if you have a vector boson staying there in your laboratories, it has a polarization which can go like that, it can go like that, and it can go like that. That's not possible for the photon because the photon zaps the speed of light. It must have only a polarization like that or like that. Okay. So now let us count what's happening. It is often stated that, let us count now the number of degrees of freedom. We started from a theory. For instance, it's important, so let us write it here so that everybody can know. We started from a theory. If the symmetry was unbroken, so in the case where the theory is unbroken, let me if T is positive, we have a gauge boson with two polarization. Okay. And a complex field with two possible states. Okay. So we had 4 degrees of freedom. 2 polarizations for the photon, and we have 2 kinds of particles. You know, if you want, for instance, you have the particle and its antiparticle because we have a complex field describing a charged boson. Okay. Now, when you go in the phase where T is negative, what do we get? We get an A mu, which is now a vector massive boson, so it has 3 polarizations. And we have a H field, which is a neutral
boson, so it has 1 degree of freedom. And we get that 2 plus 2 equals 3 plus 1. So we have, it's not inconsistent. We have not gained or lose any degrees of freedom in the theory because it's between the phase where T is positive, where the symmetry is unbroken, to the phase where T is negative and the symmetry is broken. Okay? So it's off, and that's because here, the, when I state that I have two states, it means that I had, for instance, in the phase, I could have the H field and the Goldstone boson also. Okay. So it is often stated, as you remind me, it's often found in the literature, the phrase that the gauge field has eaten the Goldstone boson. And since it had eaten something, it had become more heavy, and it became massive. Okay, so that's an analogy which is useful. Another analogy which I found more useful in my mind is the following: you start from a theory where you have one possible particle, which are particles and antiparticles. You see. And if the potential is like that, if you tap from the classical vacuum where phi equals 0, you have a zero density of particles and antiparticles. You can create particles and antiparticles pair. But on the mean, the average number of particles in the vacuum is 0. Here, it means that the vacuum is unstable. So it means that from the vacuum, you like to create pairs of particles and antiparticles. And you gain energy by creating pairs of particles and antiparticles. You see? You gain energy. And when the density of particles and antiparticles gets sufficiently high, then the interaction between particles and antiparticles takes over and limits the production of particles and antiparticles. But now those particles and antiparticles are interacting via an electromagnetic field. So they attract each other. Okay? So together, you create particles and antiparticles, but they cannot get away because they attract each other because of the electromagnetic interaction. So you end up with a mixture, you end up with a vacuum which is a very complicated condensate of particles and antiparticles, you see, and which is neutral because you have as many particles as antiparticles because the charge is conserved, you see. So you have some kind of condensate of particles and antiparticles. Condensate means that it's a very complicated superposition of states in a coherent state, okay? And which is neutral. It's still neutral. So it means that the total charge of the vacuum is still zero. And why is the total charge of the vacuum still zero? Because now the U1 symmetry is a gauge symmetry, and a gauge symmetry can never be broken. Because if it's broken, it gets an order parameter, and you can always make a gauge transformation so that this order parameter goes back to the original one. So you have you cannot have any gauge symmetry, broken symmetry, and with Goldstone boson in gauge theory. But still, you have a complicated condensate of particles and antiparticles in your ground state. And when you have a photon E, which propagates in the complicated photon propagating, it gets dressed by in the vacuum, you see. And so what is this AMU field here? This AMU field is not anymore a gauge field. It's not anymore the pi field. It's a it's a dress state or a bound state where the gauge field is dressed by the pi field, but altogether you can also say that the pi field is dressed by the gauge field. So it's so the mu field now is a very complicated combination of the original degrees of freedom. You see, and in some sense, this three polarizations which are allowed in this state, okay, correspond to the degrees of the three direction in which the electric field, the magnetic field, and the charges of this condensate of particles may fluctuate together. Okay. So that's two different ways of viewing what is a real vacuum of the theory when the symmetry has been broken because this potential has a minima. But you see that to state that the symmetry, the gauge potential has been spontaneously broken is not really a true mathematical statement because the vacuum is still neutral. Yes?
Is there like a good condensed matter analogy to this?
Yes, there is. If you give me some more time, I can develop that a little bit. But, right?
There is no time.
There is no time. Okay, so I can do that. I can say that there is a very useful condensed matter analogy, which is just the formation of charge condensate in, for instance, supraconductivity, or in the study of Bose-Einstein condensate. And many phenomena which occurs in the X model has an analogy, which is a mathematical analogy, in the physics of supraconductors. So for instance, the fact that the gauge boson becomes massive means that it doesn't propagate very easily in the medium. And this has the analogy is that in the supraconductor, the magnetic field is screened, which is called the Meissner effect. So I have no time to elaborate, but you can find that in many books. So the fact that the magnetic field is screened is the analogous of the fact that the gauge boson gets a mass. Okay, and there are many other fascinating aspects. For instance, the fact that in a supraconductor, you can have a vortex line where there is a magnetic field as an analogy is in such a theory, because in such a theory, you may have some analogous of magnetic monopoles associated to this symmetry and associated to topological effect. So there are many fascinating effects in quantum field theory where you have gauge theories and a spontaneous breaking of some of the symmetries of the theory, which is just related to the topology of the gauge symmetry group. And I stop there, but that's something I hope very much you will heard about or read about by yourself, because that's a very important part of the modern quantum field theory. Okay, thank you.